You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are so excited to bring you an author chat this episode with New York Times bestselling author Axie Oh, who joins us to talk about her latest novel, The Floating World, an epic romantic fantasy reimagining the Korean legend of Celestial Maidens, set in the world that's being pitched as Final Fantasy meets Shadow and Bone. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba and become an official Books and Boba member. Our Patreon supporters gain access to our members-only Discord server where you can chat with us and fellow members in real time. And for those of you joining us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, where on the latest episode you can hear Rira recap her wild and surprisingly harrowing experience on her recent trip to Asia. Honey Boba members also have the opportunity to suggest books for our Patrons' Choice Book Club pick once every quarter. And so, yeah, shout out to all of our members who have joined us on Patreon so far, and we would definitely love to see more of you there.
Yeah, Axie Oh is an author that we've wanted to have for a very long time on this show, so I'm really glad that we were able to get her. We talked about all the genres that she's dabbled in. We've talked about Korean myths and nerdy stuff like video games and anime. One of us.
Yeah.
So it was a very fun chat. So I hope you guys enjoy it.
Yeah. So without further ado, here is our conversation with Axie Oh.
We are here with Axie Oh, the New York Times bestselling author of The Girl Who Fell Beneath the Sea, XOXO, and ASAP, and the Rebel Soul series. And we are here to talk to her about her latest novel, The Floating World. Welcome to the show, Axie.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me. I love your guys' podcast.
Oh, thank you. Like, I remember, like, we met in person at, like, a book event. I think it was, like, Annabelle Bookstore. And I was like, hey, like, it's like, I would love to have you on our show. And I'm so glad that we were able to manifest this.
Yeah.
I know.
I feel like Rebel Soul, we learned about that book when this podcast first started. It was like on one of our earliest book news episodes. And your name has appeared on our podcast, like book news, for like years now. So like, we should finally get Axie on the podcast. So we're excited to finally have this opportunity to chat with you, because like, your books all just look so cool.
Yay, thank you for having me.
So I feel obligated to ask you this question, because you've written two novels about K-pop. What is your ultimate K-pop group?
Ooh,
which group do you stan?
Well, group or like person, because my ultimate person is IU of
okay,
all time.
Yeah,
I went to see
100%.
Her. Yeah.
Legend.
I went to see her in August. I said, I had told someone that if I'm going to spend money to see anyone, it's going to be IU. But obviously.
Yeah, I went to go see her LA show.
Yes.
Yeah, and I was just like, she never comes here, so I'm going to spend all the money
to go see her. I think we were probably at that same show.
Probably.
Was like, yeah. But my favorite group, it changes. Right now, it's probably TXT and aespa.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Obviously, I'm a huge BTS fan. Obviously, I really love NCT, but right now, my... Oh, and Twice. I love Twice. I'm just going to name all the groups.
But right I think those are solid picks.
Those are solid picks, yeah. What about you?
For me, I mean, like, my alt is BTS. It will always be BTS. However, I, like, TXT is obviously, like, like, a big part of, like, my fandom culture. And also in Hypen.
Yes.
So I call TXT my tall babies. And yeah. I call in hyphen my baby vampires.
So, oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah. Because I'm old now and yeah. like their fans are so young.
Yeah.
So
they're just our children now.
It's so weird when I go to concerts because everybody is like Gen Z dressed really stylish. Uh-huh. And they're like in high school or college. I'm like, wow, yeah. I'm like an Ajumma stan. Like yeah, I'm one of those like Ajummas who like follow their idol like as if like they have nothing else to do in life. But I'm like, I mean, this yes. is the life that
we
I chose.
Them.
So
yeah, embrace that. We embrace that. We're the Ajumma. This is our Ajumma era.
I mean, I love it. I absolutely love it.
I have nothing to contribute to this conversation as someone who's my wife was really into, I think, like H.O.T.
H.O.T.
generation. Yeah.
Finkel.
Yeah, that was a big part of we were there. We put a lot of those songs on our wedding reception.
Yeah,
playlist.
You put like SES on. And,
oh my gosh, dreams come
Finkel.
True. Oh
yeah.
I was like, I haven't heard the song in
classic
so long.
So
the nostalgia.
Yeah, I think we're a part of age group. We're like, we're locked in to our oldies now. And so like, we, you know, the new stuff just doesn't interest us. We can just listen to what we want. So why would we want to, you know, experiment?
I mean, you're missing out. There's some great music out there. But yeah, let's move on to writing. So Axie, you are one of the few who actually studied creative writing in yes. college. Uh-huh. And
UCSD.
Like a lot of people,
I went there too.
Yeah, UCSD, so really, your alma mater.
Oh yes. UCSD.
I feel like a lot of authors, they study something else and then after they get like their first adult job, they kind of find their way back into writing. So I'm just curious to hear, like, when did you start writing? And like, were you always I guess like Marvin always asks this question, but I'll ask it. Like, were your parents supportive of your choice to go into the creative field?
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky. My mother's side of the family, they're actually architects. So they really respect art. So my grandfather, he's very famous in Korea. His name is Kim Chung-up. He's a very famous architect. He designed the 1988 Olympic Gate. As well as as well as the Sabil building and like other like the French embassy. So like arts were very something. Like my mom studied creative design in interior design in college. So like when I wanted to be a writer, it was actually my mom was very like, yeah, sure. Very supportive. But yeah, I started writing when I was in college, but the reason I went into creative writing was because in high school I wrote my college essay that got me into UCSD. But I wrote my college essay and I showed it to my English literature professor at the time, or my teacher at the time, and he read it and he started crying. And then he like ran across the hallway to the math teacher and showed it to him, and he started crying, and I was like, oh, I have so much power. And then they were like, oh, maybe you should try studying creative writing in college. And I was like, I never thought of that. I was always been a big reader, but it never crossed my mind that you could be a writer. Like that could be a thing. And so when I was in college, I did a creative writing. Like it was like a double major. It was like writing, literature, creative writing, plus history. Because I was like, maybe I'll be a teacher or an editor. I still wasn't sure if I would be a writer. And then when I graduated, I actually moved to New York City and I worked in publishing for a year. I worked at a literary agency, but for that entire year, I actually didn't write because I was just so tired after working like the 9 to 5 reading other people's writing and like editing it and like going through all the process. I was getting like tired. And so after the year was over, I like called my mom and I was like, can I come home and like pursue a master's in writing? Can I try to really take this seriously? And the course that I wanted to take was just doing it the education wise, because I thought, oh, then maybe I can teach in the future, I thought. And then I heard of these writing they're called low residency programs. So you don't have to be on campus all year, and they're short. They're just 2 years, and it's you only have to be on campus, I think, like 14 days twice, like once, twice a year, 14 days on campus. And so I was like, this is great. So I moved back home with my parents, and I went to school. That's how I went to get my master's. So that was sort of, and then during that time was when I entered the New Visions Award, which is what published my first book, Rebel Soul. So the New Visions Award is an award given to unpublished, unagented authors of color by Lee and Low Books. And if you win the award, then they publish your book. So that's sort of how I got my foot into publishing.
Yeah, actually, that was like my next question. I was going to ask you about like your experience, like winning the New Visions Award and getting a contract, because this is a very unconventional way to get represented. And like, was Rebel Soul your first manuscript, or was it like did you already have a novel in the drawer and you're like, okay, time to work on something else?
Yeah, I did have a novel in the drawer. I wrote this like epic portal fantasy, as one does. I loved it. And then I queried 5 people who didn't even represent fantasy because I wanted to be rejected so I could get it over with. Because I knew it wasn't very good. So I put it in the drawer. And then, yes, my second book was actually Rebel Soul. And I had written the full book. And then I started querying it, but it wasn't getting... I was getting a lot of rejections that were like, dystopian is dead. We don't want like sci-fi. And I was kind of like, oh, I didn't know you had so many Korean dystopians that it's dead now. That's what I was thinking. And then the New Visions Award, I came upon it at a conference at ALA, the American Library Association conference, that came to my hometown, Vegas. And I just went in and someone gave me a flyer for it. I had never heard of it before. And then I was like, oh, this is really cool. And so I submitted it without an agent. Right. And then after it won the award, that's when I got my agent. So I was able to kind of hook an agent by saying I won this award. And also at that time I had written The Girl Who Fell Beneath the Sea. That was actually my third book. Even though it came out after XOXO, I actually wrote it before XOXO.
Publishing works in weird ways. time is really weird. And sometimes your second novel becomes your third or fourth novel. Yeah. We've seen that. We've encountered that quite a few times doing this podcast.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, you know, your name, your books always stuck out to me because, you know, your first published book, Rebel Soul, was about giant robots. And this was like the early day. I want to say it's early days of like, you know, you were probably one of the OG speculative fiction, like Asian American writers. And, you know, it was just like, oh, someone's writing about giant robots, like in English first, like book. That's really cool. I wanted to ask, like, what inspired you to get into writing, you know, fantasy, science fiction stories?
I mean, from early childhood, I just really love, obviously, fantasy. I really love sci-fi. I'm a huge anime. Marvin, you can see in my background, which the podcast can't see. It's all like toys. But I just always loved like storytelling from Asia. Not necessarily books, because we didn't really have that growing up. But we had K-dramas. We had Toonami. But then with...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then with books, obviously, I loved his Dark Materials. Obviously, I loved a lot of the retellings growing up. Like, I read a lot of Robin McKinley. I read a lot of Gail Carson Levine. These are, like, fantasy authors. Or their YA. Like, I guess... Well, I don't know when YA really picked up the term, but these were like children's book fantasy authors, Diana Wynne Jones. But then when I was in college, actually, I went to a book signing at Mysterious Galaxy, because UCSD, right? So I went to Mysterious Galaxy, and it was a panel of a bunch of authors, but one of the authors was Cindy Pan, a Taiwanese-American author, and I believe she's promoting Silver Phoenix at the time. But then I saw her again, and she's promoting her short story in Diverse Energies, which was published by Two Books. But in Diverse Energies, there's a short story called Want, which was like a sci-fi dystopia set in Taiwan. And I was like, this is amazing. I was like, I read that story. I think it's in that short story collection. Anyway, if it's not, sorry. But it's Want, the short story. And then she later rewrote, expanded into a novel. Yeah, into the full novel. And anyway, just like seeing her, I was like, I didn't even know that this is so cool. It's like an anime in a story form. And that sort of inspired me to write Rebel Soul. So like it was interesting because the year Rebel Soul came out, Want came out, the full novel, Sidney Pond's full novel, and also Marie Lu's War Cross came out. Yeah. And so that was really cool to be like, oh, there are three sci-fi, yeah, Asian sci-fi books, like one set in Japan, one set in Taiwan, one set in Korea. And I was like, this is so cool. And Cindy kind of became like a mentor to me too, which was really cool. But yeah, that was sort of like seeing Cindy at the bookstore, like seeing for the first time an Asian author in person, sort of was very inspiring to me because I was like, oh, Asian people can write books and like they can be cool. You know, they don't have to be about the immigrant experience, which is fine. I love immigrant experience stories, but I also just want to like, you know, fight in giant robots too. Like I want both.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sidney Pond is like really OG. Like,
yeah.
I feel like she is like the first Asian American author that a lot of people encounter when they, you know, first dive into that subset of like authors and literature.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've read quite a few science fiction fantasy books on this podcast, and it's always interesting because we've read, you know, some like Chinese science fiction, some Japanese science fiction. It's always cool to see what, you know, speculative fiction looks like in other cultures, and specifically like it, for me, it's always cool to see one from like Asian American perspective, which is something that you and, you know, Marie and Cindy all do. So I've always been curious. I wanted to ask, like, you know, personally for you, like what makes for you an Asian American science fiction fantasy, like speculative fiction story? Like what are the themes that are important to you, or like, yeah, what makes it?
Yeah, it's interesting because all the stories I've written so far kind of take place in a second world. Well, besides Rebel Soul, which just takes place in like a futuristic, I guess, AU South Korea, because it's, you know, giant robots, it's like a totalitarian state, dystopia. And then The Girl Fell Beneath the Sea is like a second world fantasy. It's kind of based off of like a historical Korea. And then The Floating World is like straight second world fantasy. It's very... I was inspired by Korean culture, but it's very, you know, it's supposed to be just very different. Like it's not attached to any actual history or actual, I guess, the geography. We'll get into that. But for like, I guess the Korean American part of it is just my modern lens, like growing up as a Korean American. So like a lot of the stories that I'm retelling or that I'm talking about, you know, some of them came about during times of Confucianism, like the Tale of Xin Cheng, which is the story retelling The Girl Fell Beneath the Sea. And obviously, from a modern lens, I take out some of the things that I don't, or I explore and challenge some of the things that I think, you know, a feminist viewpoint would challenge. And I also change things like in the Tale of Xin Cheng, she's actually, so this tale is like a very old story about a blind man whose daughter is sacrificed, or she volunteers to sacrifice herself to the sea god for her father, for three, I think it's like 300 or three bags of rice. And it's like a filial piety kind of story. And then at the end, they're reunited and the father is cured of his blindness. And I was like, that's very ableist. That's like, I'm completely taking that out of my book. Things like that, like just the modern lens sort of element. And then I guess for like the Korean element, to me, it's it's not like even purposeful or intentional in a way. It's like, it's so interesting to me when people read the book and they're like, oh, I really connect to like the family stuff. I really connect to just like some of the language I use or some of the relationship dynamics I do. And I think that's just that's just like intrinsic to being Korean. It's sort of, I guess there's like the whole iceberg thing where you have like the world building where the things you can see and then the things below. The things you can see are like food, aesthetic and that kind of stuff. But then the things below the iceberg are like family ties, like jokes. okay, this is like totally tangent, but have you ever seen My Sassy Girl?
Yes.
With Jeon Ji-hyun, yeah.
I've seen the highlights.
Oh, it's so good. But that movie has so much like Korean humor that like a lot of only Korean people or East Asian people or like have the similar kind of cultural things will like think it's funny. But anyway, so things like that where it's like there's things that only if you're like in the culture you might recognize. But if you're not, there's still really interesting and cool things that you can take from it too. And I think that's really cool about writing from your own culture, your own heritage.
That's true. I always love like clocking like space Confucianism or like fantasy patriarchy when I'm reading like fantasy books and speculative fiction books from like Asian American authors. Cause it's definitely, oh yeah, these are problems with our culture that we're exploring in a fantasy world. That's cool.
It's like we call it as we see it. So
yeah.
So you've dabbled in many genres. You like mentioned your other books, like Rebel Soul is sci-fi dystopia, Aesop and XOXO are contemporary romances set in like a K-pop backdrop, and The Girl Who Fell Beneath the Sea, secondary fantasy based on Korean mythology. So does your writing process change with each genre, and do you have like a natural affinity with a specific genre?
My writing process does, I don't know if it changes based on genre. I think it changes based on how much of the story I know. So XOXO actually, I wrote really fast, and I think it was because I knew the story really well. I knew the story I wanted to tell. Same with The Girl Who Fell Beneath the Sea, but ASAP and, The Floating World took a really long time to write, and I think it's because I didn't know the story, so I was like exploring as I was writing it, so it was taking a long time, and then I kept going off into like wrong tangents, I had to come back and had to rewrite it, so those took longer because I wasn't as sure of the story from the beginning. I didn't have as strong of a voice. Like The Girl Who Fell Beneath the Sea and XOXO, the voice of Mina from Girl and Jenny from XOXO came to me like from the beginning, so their voices were really strong to me, so it was easier for me to write their perspectives, but that wasn't necessarily the case with Sori from ASAP and Ren from The Floating World, I think it's interesting because actually XOXO and ASAP took more research than the fantasy books.
Because it's like, based in the real world. You can't get those things wrong.
Yeah. I was like, oh my gosh. So it's just funny because like the floating, you would think there'd be like way more floating world, like research and world building going into Floating World and The Girl Film You Need to See. And there is like, especially world building, but research wise, it was so hard for XOXO and ASA. Actually, I did so much research on cello playing for XOXO, because K-pop, it was sort of like, I didn't actually want to do too much research because I didn't want to be like, I feel like I didn't want it to be too, I don't even know the word, but fan fiction-y, or I didn't want to pull the reader out, like I'm trying to teach them something about K-pop. So I tried actually not to do any research for that. And I was sort of just relied on, you know, being a fan since those H.O.T. and Finkel era, you know what I mean? Just being a fan my whole life, I kind of just, that was sort of the quote unquote research I pulled from. And then all the other research was like, you know, how long it takes to get from, you know, Seoul Station to this area, how to play the cello. Because I don't play the cello. I play the harp. So I have been in an orchestra and I have performed, but I've never played the cello, which I chose that instrument because the harp was too large. So she can't walk around with that. She needs a different instrument.
What we're learning here is Axie is just a very holistic writer. She engages like the processing. She has like different modes of processing for real world books and also fantasy books, because like for me, I feel like the processing power needed to create a whole new world from scratch seems like a lot. But I can also see how like trying to get right in real world, making sure it's authentic, is also like there's pressure there as well.
I'm trying to remember who it was, but it was someone we had on the podcast, and like they wrote their book during COVID, and the book is set in Tokyo, and they were just like, I couldn't go, so I had to rely on like Google Maps. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds about right when it comes to writing books set in like actual real places, where like you have to make sure those places exist, and or else people are going to point it out and be like, this is wrong. Like, you didn't do your research. So, yeah, yeah. Different priorities when it comes to fantasy versus contemporary. I wanted to move into your latest book, The Floating World. Congratulations on reaching the New York Times bestsellers list. That's like so awesome. I think you also reached like the indie like bestsellers list as well. So congratulations. What was your reaction when you heard? Like, what were you doing?
So happy. Oh, what was I doing? Well, actually, the way it works is that it comes, the publisher knows before. So I knew about the indie, like, I think the indie's release on Wednesday, but publishers know about it on Tuesday. So it came in, like, so I knew about the indie on Tuesday. So I was like, yay, kind of like it's such a great feeling. And then the New York Times publishers know about it at, like, I don't know, 2 o'clock, but it goes live at like 4. So I knew about it maybe 2 hours before. And I think, my friend who works in publishing, she texted me a screenshot of her screen that had it before my publisher even could tell me, my editor could even tell me. So I saw it. My friend is the one who texted me. She texted me like 9 minutes before, and I was like, ah, and she was like, ah, look, look, look. So she texted me, and then and then I got like the emails from my team, and that was really exciting. And yeah, it was just like, yeah, it was very exciting. I went to Ikalbi celebration.
Yeah. So for our listeners who might not be familiar with your newest book, can you give us like a brief elevator pitch for what The Floating World is all about?
Yeah, The Floating World is about a sword for hire and a acrobat who go on this like world's altering adventure. But basically, I guess it's not the elevator pitch because it'd be a little longer. But basically, my main
it could be a long elevator ride.
It's your pitch, so okay. We're stuck in here with you.
My main character Ren, she's a troupe performer, and she's traveling with her troupe village to village, and one of the villages is attacked by a demon, and she releases this silver light that destroys the demon, but it also fills the sky. And then far away across the mountains, to the place called the Floating World, they see the light, and they realize that the person that should have died 10 years ago is actually alive. So they send, I think it's like 95 assassins after her. And then there's 5 other people that are also sent. And one of them is Hun Ho, my sword for hire, who's sent to protect the girl who wields the silver light. So it's sort of, they're on these sort of journeys that are going to collide and go on this fun, like, video game-esque adventure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely got Final Fantasy VII and 13 vibes. And I was like, I know Axie is definitely a video game player. Like, I can picture it. Yes. I can also picture, like, her, like, I don't know, like, the book reminded me of Laputa because it's also, like, a floating, like, country in the sky. So I'm like, she's one of us. She's one of us nerds.
Yeah. I will say the intro chapters were such, like, opening act of a JRPG. Especially Sung Ho's opening, your swordsman's opening act, which I think because the tagline for this book was Final Fantasy meets Shadow and Bone, the opening act for him was like a heist / sabotage mission, and it just had the intro music for Final Fantasy VII playing in my head while I was reading the whole part.
Yeah, I pitched it to my editor before I even wrote the book. I said it's going to be like a Final Fantasy hero meets a Studio Ghibli heroine, because I just I love shonen so much, but you know shonen doesn't usually have that much romance. And I was like, okay, I kind of want to put a shonen and shoujo together. So it's like you have a lot of action, but you also have romance. Like I really wanted, as a reader, that's just like what I wanted to satisfy. So that's what I was trying to go for. And yeah, the inspirations, like aesthetically for sure. And the character of Cloud was like very inspires Hun Ho. And then Ren was like, you know, like Studio Ghibli heroines in general are like awesome. They're like, you know, so strong.
Very wholesome. Characters. You know,
very wholesome. Yeah. And so I just wanted those like vibes for her in her like idyllic village that's then attacked by a demon. And so it was sort of like funny because like her life is like so idyllic and he's like suffering in this like dark world. And I was like, oh, this is fun. It's like a dark and light world coming together. I thought it would be really fun.
Yeah. Sunshine and Grumpy pairing for sure. So like the floating world is partly inspired by the Korean myth, the woodcutter and the celestial maiden. Since like your previous book, The Girl Who Fell Beneath the Sea, like that's like a retelling of a Korean myth. So this is kind of like in your wheelhouse. But I'm curious, like what about the myth piqued your interest? Like talk us through how that kernel of an idea grew into like a whole novel from this one myth.
Yeah. So after I wrote The Girl Fell Beneath the Sea, I'm sure you guys know, if you call all the authors, we have like the option clause in our contracts. Mm-hmm. Like, what are you going to write next? And so mine was for YA fantasy. So I was like, what am I going to write next? And you kind of always want to tie whatever you write next to your first book so that, you know, people who read your first book, they have something else to read after. And so I was like, okay, so if I'm going to work with another Korean legend or myth, what's it going to be? That was sort of my starting point. And then I was like, the two that I was most familiar with was The Tale of Shim Chung and then this one, The Woodcutter and the Celestial Maiden. These were the two that I was the most familiar with. And then The Woodcutter and Celestial Maiden also is similar to like Selkie stories and Swan Maiden stories. So it has like a precedent. So it's basically a story about a magical woman, right? So Celestial Maiden, she comes down from the heavens, she bathes in the rock pool, and then her magic wings are stolen by a human, which basically traps her on Earth. So that's what it's like, kind of like a Swan Maiden or like a Selkie story. And so I just, the themes of that, like, were just so, like, to me, were very heart-wrenching. And there was also, I did a lot of, like, research on the legend itself, because the story I knew from The Woodcutter and Celestial Maiden, but I also was reading about just legends in general, about Celestial Maidens in general, because there's a lot of like rock pools in Korea, a lot of waterfall pools in Korea. So I guess there's just like a lot of legends of like women bathing in rock pools. And I was like, okay. So I just was reading a lot about this legend. And then from there, I was like, well, what if she had, besides like her wings, what if she had other powers? And so that was sort of, I added in stuff like that, like the idea of, because like celestial maidens also appear in obviously in other Asian myths, like in India. And so I was like, okay, what kind of powers am I going to give her? And I was like, well, if she is from the sky, then she has to have light powers. And then so I was sort of just like adding powers to the character, sort of like Sailor Moonified her. Because I was like, she's going to be a magical girl. And also because The Girl Fell Beneath the Sea was like Mina, my main character, she was like a human in a world of gods. Ren is sort of like a goddess in a world of humans. And I thought that was a really fun thing to play with. And so it was sort of like the spark of the idea came from the legend. And I try to really make it into a plot point in the book. And then even more so actually in the sequel. But then I sort of just went from there, just added all this different stuff to it because I just wanted to make it more exciting for me to write, even if it's not necessarily in the original legend about them.
Yeah, I mean, the original legend, the message is all men are garbage. And it's definitely one of those stories where like, it's like, oh, I don't know if you should stay with this toxic man who like stole your property. And I think there's like, there's different endings for that myth as well. There's like one ending where, you know, like the husband, he managed to make it up to like the Skyland and he becomes like, he like has to serve the wife's family. And he has like, so like the roles are kind of switched and he's like, I kind of want to go back.
He wants to like go back to his mom who takes care of him all the time.
Yeah, so I was just like, I'm glad that there were actual, like, nice guys in your book, because in the original legend, not so much.
Yeah, it was sort of like, I wanted to explore that too. And then I said, like, in the second book, there's more, I tackle more of, like, the themes of that actual story, which was really fun for me, because it was like, I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah, I mean, as we know, in Final Fantasy games, the final boss is always God or some sort of
or like death. So let's talk about world building. So your book provides two stunning maps, one of Serenia and Volmar, and then the other of the underworld. And I love maps in any kind of fantasy novel. And it's also like very helpful for me to like map out how far everything is in the journey. and like follow characters. But I'm curious, like, did the world's landscape come first, or was it like constructed after you figured out like, okay, these are my characters and this is where they have to go, and you kind of like mapped it out later?
Yeah, it was definitely the latter. It was like, oh, they're going on this journey, and this is why I was like, okay, so they have, I was like, oh, so she has to be far away enough that they, so I was like, okay, there has to be a mountain here. So it was sort of like, as the story was going, I was like, okay, now I have to add a river, and it has, you know, so it was like, as the story progressed, that's when I added things to the map. And then when I was told that there was going to be a map, so I actually drew a very crude, very bad map. And then I was told that there was going to be a map, and I was like, oh no, now I have to draw it nicely and really think about it and have to think about like directions. And oh my gosh, it was so hard. I drew the map. what I did is I printed out a blank map of South Korea.
I recognized like the peninsula part. And yeah. I was like, okay, yeah, and the mountains. Yeah. I was like, okay, yeah. This is alternate universe Korea. Got it.
Yes, yes. I printed out a map of like South Korea, and then I just redrew it. That's basically what I did for my map, because I was like, I just don't know. Otherwise, just like a blob in my mind. And so I gave it some form that way. And then, yeah. And so, and then with the underworld, I printed out a map of like, I Googled like a circle cut into nine, and I just printed that out. And then I just like wrote on it. And then, yeah, but it was interesting, because every time after that was all done, and this actually happened after we had done copy edits. And so we're going into past pages, and then the map was finished. And then I was like, oh no, now I have to check every single direction. Every time anyone mentions a direction in the book, I have to check it. Because I was like, well, now there's a map. So there's, I can't get anything wrong because you can check it.
Yeah, so, you can introduce script supervising into your fantasy story.
Yeah. So it was really, it was like a challenge, but it was fun. And actually also like forced me to choose things. I was like, okay, the base has to be here now. Like I have to choose where the base goes now, things like that. Because before it was sort of like a blob in my mind. I was kind of like, well, it could be here, it could be there.
But now you have an awesome fantasy like map in your book. Like, you know, did you have a map person who like finalized the map for you, or like?
Yeah. So the map person, her name's Virginia Allen, and she's like, she does a lot of the YA fantasy maps. So I think she does like most of them actually. And she's great. She does all of like Elizabeth Lim's maps. She does Stephanie Garber's maps. She was like my dream map maker. So when they said they're getting her, I was like, oh my gosh, thank you. And then I felt so much pressure to make the map like easy for her to understand. I knew that I don't have that. The only thing I know how to draw is like a bunny. And so I was like, there's no way I can even try to draw this map to make it look good. But at least I want it to be easy for her to, you know, look at and recreate. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just going to say like, oh, there's a floating country in the sky. I don't know how you're going to map that, but it's there.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about your magic system, because I thought it was like pretty interesting, because your book is like a blend of steampunk, like we said, like Final Fantasy. And then you have folktale, which, you know, is the Korean myth part. So how did you come up with the rules of magic in your book and like the restrictions for it?
Yeah. So I stuck with basically those two things. So I did, there were only two magic quote unquote, well, there are two magic systems in the book. One magic system is just celestial maidens. So only celestial maidens have powers. Everyone else is technically human, or everyone else is human. And so my main character, she's from like a matrilineal line, like her, like she's descendant from the original celestial maiden. So like all of the maidens, only their daughters have powers. And then, I mean, there's some plot points in the book, but anyway, that's like the idea. And then the other magic system that I was working with was the floating world. So the floating world floats in the sky, but underneath the floating world is like mines. And in the mines is a ore. And I called it mithril, which is basically very JRPG like nod, because like, you know, mithril weapons appear in like most JRPG games. And it's a ore that for me in the book has magical properties. And so the magical properties is why the floating world floats, right? And then if you take the ore and do things with it, that could also equal like magical things, like in a sci-fi way, like you could liquefy it, it is gaseous form. It like is very toxic. And then, but you can liquefy it, inject it into people. What does that do? That sort of thing. So all the magic is tied with the ore. So there won't be any other magic besides what the mithril can do. And then the celestial medium. So that was sort of like the two rules. And I tried to stick with them. So like even the airships and the aircraft in the book, the reason they fly is because they have mithril cores. So they have like a stone inside them that like lets them levitate. Yeah, that's sort of the magic system I was trying to go with.
So your book juggles, you know, multiple POVs in third person view. You have Ren, you have Sonho, you have Chael, and like, I'm always really amazed when authors have multiple POVs because I'm like, how do you keep track of the story and how do you, you know, maintain their voice? So how did you go about capturing each of your characters' voices in this POV? And also, like, did you write linearly in chronological order, or did you like stick to one character's POV for like long stretches of time?
Yeah, I definitely wrote it in linear order. I write all my books that way, chronologically, because I can't, if I don't, I feel like I lose track of the thread of the plot. Like I kind of like basically like carrying this thread throughout the book is basically I'm trying to like lead it through the book. And if I don't, if I write off, right out of order, that to me is harder. But Sonho was actually, of the characters, he was the easiest in terms of voice for me to write. His voice came to me very strongly from the beginning. And then Chael actually also, he was really fun to write because his voice also came to me very strongly. It was like a kind of sarcastic, kind of morally gray character, which are always really fun to write. But then Ren was really hard to write. Actually, I rewrote her chapters, the beginning chapters, at least like 5-6 times, and the entire book in first person point of view the first time. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. So in the first time I ever wrote the book, it was her all her chapters were first person, and then Sonho was third, Chael was third, and then I rewrote the book in third person, her perspective, after I reached the end, because then I knew her. It took me an entire book to like know who she was, what her whole purpose was, like what she wanted, her whole driving, her character arc. And once I learned that and I knew her voice, then I could go back and write her from the beginning in third person. So it took a long time. That's what I was saying. Like, that's why it took longer. The Floating World took longer because she was so hard. Ren, she was my problem child for this book. But once I nailed down like her voice, figured it out, then, you know, it was much more easier to like switch back and forth. So when I revise, I don't necessarily have to revise linearly. I can revise out of order because at that point I know the story and I know the voices and I know like I already tied it together. So now it's just about really perfecting each chapter, really getting out everything out. And yeah, so that was sort of, I had always knew it was going to be Ren and Sonho. Chael, I did know he was going to be in the book in the beginning because I needed someone in the inside. Because my main character, like one of them has amnesia, so he doesn't even know, he doesn't know what's happening. The other one's like been trying to repress her past for 10 years. So, you know, she doesn't want to face the facts. And so I needed a character who's like, this is what's happening. This was actually happening.
Yeah.
That was sort of like why I added a third character.
And obviously you needed someone with history.
Oh, Ren with as Ren.
Well, right?
Yeah. I needed a character who could tie her to her past. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm always amazed because, you know, epic fantasy stories, it's not just the character, the main character you're following, but also like everyone around them, like there's politics at work and like agendas of like a lot of different characters. And you have a pretty wide cast of characters with like different agendas, different things they want. How is your process in like keeping all those, like, you know, as your main characters are progressing, so are all your other background characters also progressing? How do you keep that in order when you write?
Yeah, I sort of like, so I have like the small, like a smaller cast per each character. So like Ren has her adoptive family. So I have that like smaller cast with her chapters until, you know, she meets Sonho. And then Sonho has his smaller cast with, he meets the rebels, Yurhin Tag, who are like the fun side characters who like drop really fun one-liners. And then also like just like his neighbors, people he like comes in contact with. And then I have Chael, who's like who he's the son of the general who's the villain. So you see the villain in his chapter. I really wanted I also wanted to introduce the villain early on. So you knew early on like who the villain for book one was. Early on, so that the reader wasn't like, who is this villain, like the whole time. Like you meet him early on in Jael's chapter. I wasn't trying too hard to think about like everyone at once. I was kind of thinking about each character and their like sort of small cast around them at the time. And then they would meet up and then the cast, you know, changes based on, you know, like who you're meeting, what new characters are being introduced. It was, since it's such a book that's focused on the two main characters, Ren and Sano, was kind of like, in a way, it was kind of harder to be like, how do I create, and it's a journey book too. So they're meeting characters and some characters they're just never going to see again. Like they meet this like fun boatman who takes them on their boat and like, I love this guy. He had like great beard, but I was like, they're never going to see this guy again. So there are things like that where I was like, well, I wanted to sort of bring in those side characters more. So that was a challenge for me to be like, how am I going to bring them in? Right. When like, you know, so sort of that was a fun challenge. And then I really play with them more in the sequel. But yeah. And even like Tag and Yurhi, in like one of the first versions of that book, Tag was like an old man.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
He was like an old man. He has a very like old man personality.
Yeah. Yeah. He was like an old man. And then I was like, no, Sano needs a friend. And so I aged him to be 17 so that they could be buddies. But yeah, in a couple of versions, he was just like an old dude. And then I was like, I don't have enough young people in this book. That was sort of like go on this journey with them. So I was like, hey, I have to age him down. So like, that's why, you know, things like that, because it's a YA book. So, you know, you want your cast to be young.
To be 17 again. And,
yeah. In the fantasy world.
Going on world-changing journeys.
Yes.
Like back when you thought anything was possible on you.
That's right.
So all of your books have beautiful covers. I think you really hit the jackpot when it comes to covers. And I know a lot of authors don't have any say in how their covers turn out. So how involved were you in the making of the Floating World cover? Because...
It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's like straight up graphic novel, like the level of detail. I'm like, dang, like dang. it looks so good.
Yeah. So the whole process was so interesting because like originally they came to me and they're like, oh, just so you know, like they were being really apologetic. We're not going to get Curry Huang again for your cover because Curry did The Girl Who Fell Beneath the Sea. And I was like, oh, okay. And there, and I was like, that's actually okay with me. I was thinking in my head because the book is so different than The Girl Who Fell Beneath the Sea. So I didn't want people to be like, oh, it's like a sequel or it's going to be very similar to the first book. And then like, but we did get Guez. And I was like, what? What? Because I'm a big fan of that artist. He did Jade Fire Gold for June Seal Tan. And he's also just like a really like famous artist. And so I knew who he was. I was a big fan. I had like his art on my Pinterest aesthetic board. So I was like, what? So I knew that was going to happen. They showed me the first run of it. I think they asked me what I wanted on the cover. And then I kind of just gave character descriptions. And then I said like what some of the symbols were, like her mask, his scarf. Like I just kind of told them, you know, things that connect to the book. Cause they did a really good job with that, with The Girl Who Fell Beneath the Sea. They had like the Red String of Fate. They had, the magpie and lotus flowers. So like symbols in the book they put on the cover. And so they said they're going to do the same thing. And then they showed me the first draft of it. And it was basically what you see. It was like basically what you see. They weren't holding hands. That was only difference. And so the one edit we did was, can you make them holding hands? And then he did. He made them holding hands. And then I was like, oh, my gosh. It's romantic. So that was sort of, yeah. And then with the sequel, they showed me the first draft. And I was like, oh, my God, he looks like Marth from Fire Emblem. that was my feedback. And I was like, it was supposed to be a good thing. And then they, like, you know, edited it a little bit to make it, you know, there were some things in the first version of the cover that also kind of spoiled the first book intensely. So I was like, can we try to like make it less obvious, this some spoilers? So those were, that was sort of the edits that I gave back. But it was very, very like first draft is perfect. Yeah, I was so happy. Yeah, all my books, so happy with the covers.
I love that. Like, you're like, okay, let's not spoil the story, but they need, people need to know these two are an item. They need to know they're holding hands.
Yeah. They need to hold hands. Yeah.
Like, they need to know that they're endgame. Like,
yes.
I mean, we love that reassurance as readers. Like, okay, like, are the characters going to get together? Is there going to be chemistry? So it's nice to know that, like, from the get-go.
Yeah. I was just saying, if you're in a bookstore, you walk past this book and don't stop and stare at this cover, you're dead inside. Like, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely dead inside, because I mean there's a lot of covers out there where it's just text, and I'm like, I'm so glad we've kind of like moved past that trend, because I just love like really detailed covers. And like you mentioned your sequel, The Demon and the Light, and I can definitely see Marth from Fire Emblem in the cover.
In the cover.
I was so surprised because the book is coming out in October this year. That's so soon. It's so like, what can we expect for like from our heroes in the sequel?
Yeah, so I knew from the beginning that the books would actually be a 7th month release apart. That was sort of the that was sort of the marketing they did for Judy Lin for a magic steeped in poison in her sequel. They were like also, I think it was either 6 months, 5 months apart. So that was sort of, it did really, you know, it worked really well for her. So they really wanted that to be part of the sales marketing for this book. So I knew in 2021 that it was going to be 2 books. And so I didn't write them. I kind of, you know, I wrote them knowing that. So that's why they, I was able to publish them so close together. It was always planned that way. It wasn't like I was like, I wrote them really fast.
Did you write them all in one go, or was there a break in the middle? Like, that's
I did write them. Actually, this is interesting because I was writing ASAP actually at the same time as The Floating World, so that was hard. So I actually wrote, I think, half of each book, and then I was like, oh, this is too hard. Wow. And I had to push The Floating World so that I could finish ASAP on time. So we pushed The Floating World because I think it was supposed to come out originally like 2024. And then we pushed it so that I could finish ASAP so that, you know, I wasn't doing 2 books in once because that was just too hard. And then after The Floating World, I went straight into Demon in the Light. So I did go straight into another book, but I did have a break because, you know, I was like working on, like, I did like The Floating World draft and then, or did half The Floating World, half ASAP, finished ASAP, finished Floating World, had to go back and do ASAP edits, you know, and then I went back to, and then I went to The Demon of Light. So it was kind of like doing a juggling act. So it's actually been really fun to be like, yeah, The Floating World came out and you can read the sequel in like 6 months.
Yeah, it was definitely a shock when I reached like the last page. It was like, coming out October 2025. It was like 2025.
Yeah. Like, usually we have to wait like a year or two for the next one. So
yeah, I'm just like, cool. I'm used to waiting like 9 months to like a year. This like, this is new. Like,
Yeah. So
I know my friends are like, I hope you don't set a precedent and we all have to have books released twice a year. I was like, no. This is just like, I knew about this since 2021. It's not like everyone has to write their books super fast now.
Yeah. So needs to say, I assume second book's already done since like arcs are already out and everything.
Yeah.
So gotta ask, since like, you seem to like to keep yourself busy, are you working on anything else right now?
I am, but I'm not contracted for anything right now. So this is like the first time since 2019 when I sold XOXO that I haven't had a book contract, which is really actually really exciting because now I can just do whatever I want. I'm like, I can write whatever I want. I still have a fantasy option, so I can write a fantasy, a YA fantasy, but I could also write sci-fi. I could write contemporary. So that's really exciting. So I'm kind of going to spend the summer figuring out what I want to write next. That's sort of my goal.
Yeah.
You should pick another genre. Really, just expand a fourth genre. Expand the pantheon of Axie O genres. I would love to see a historical fiction novel.
That is such a challenge. Historical is probably the hardest genre, right? Because of all the research involved. Okay, for you, Mira, I'll do it.
Or like a murder mystery would be fun too, maybe.
Oh, that'd be fun. The murder mystery thriller. K-drama is like a really
harder. Because
that's true, because you have to like do a lot of like setup and stuff. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I've left like the harder genres for last.
You studied Korean history though. I believe in you. You can do historical fiction.
Maybe because I studied Korean history, I'm so intimidated by it because it's like, oh, I have to get everything right. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm like such a big Joon-hur fan that I love her books.
Yeah.
Because I love historical fiction. And then, yeah.
Or just, you know, historical fiction, but make it space. I think that would work too.
Oh, yeah.
That's not historical fiction.
How does that work? How does that work? Yeah, if it's historical. Unless it's like a retelling of history.
Could be
space.
A Star Wars thing, Galaxy Far, Far Away, a long time ago.
That's
you know?
Not historical fiction. It's sci-fi.
I just want my space Chosun... Court drama.
All right. Okay. I'll have to do space Chosun court drama for you, Marvin. And then for you, Mira, I'll do historical fiction.
Thank you. Thank you for
it'll be dedicated to you guys.
Yeah.
Well, Axie, thank you so much for we're glad we finally have you on the podcast. Yeah. Looking forward to whatever your next book becomes. Don't you know, no pressure. You know, if you want to just write like a cozy, you know, story about someone like, you know, making coffee or something, that'd be fine too. But yeah, congratulations on the success of your novel, and you know, we're so excited for the sequel coming up in a few months. I'm very excited to when that drops as well.
Oh my gosh, hey, thanks you guys, it was so much fun being on this podcast, a dream of mine. Yay, life goal achieved.
And that was our conversation with Axie O. Her latest novel, The Floating World, is available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Boba Bookshop. So if you're interested in picking up a copy of the book after listening to our conversation, head on over to our website, booksandboba.com, and check out our bookshop link. All purchases made on our online bookstore support not only us at Books and Boba, but also your local bookstore. So kind of a win-win situation. All right, before we call an episode, Rira, can you remind us what book we are reading for our May 2025 book club pick?
Yeah, so we are reading Blob, A Love Story by Maggie Sue, and it's a humorous, satirical novel about a young woman who tries to shape a sentient blob into her boyfriend.
Yeah, it's a pretty simple premise, but the book is a lot of things, and especially it's a book about, you know, that Midwest Asian American crisis of identity. And so, you know, we're finishing our read on Discord if you are a Patreon supporter. So if you have any thoughts to share, make sure to jump on there, let us know. And if you finish a book and aren't a member of our Patreon, you can also let us know your thoughts by going to our Goodreads forums and giving us your feedback there. As always, we'd love to include your feedback in our discussion episodes whenever possible. That'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. As always, we are a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, so check out our fellow Asian American hosted podcasts, especially during this Heritage Month, by going to the website podcastpotluck.com. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to Axie O for joining us, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, sports fans. Welcome to Asians in Hockey. You may not realize it, but there's a rich history of Asians and AAPI folks who have contributed to the legacy of the greatest game on ice. From classic legends like Julie Chu and Robin Bawa, to current greats like Lia Lum and Nick Suzuki, and even rising stars like Akane Shiga and Jason Robertson. We'll cover their stories, celebrate their accomplishments, and learn about their impact on the sport of hockey. I'm Nate Nakao, former Beer League player, occasional youth hockey coach, and longtime hockey fan, and I'll be your host as we take a look at the rise of Asians in hockey. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.